I kind of had to dig a little bit deep about security and insecurities and what I brought to the party and whether I was ready to kind of step up to what was understood to be sort of the construction big leagues.
All right, welcome back, everybody. This is number 9 of our Essential Craftsman podcast. We are sitting down. It's the afternoon. We've been working all day. Well, I've only worked half a day. You've worked all day. What time did you get up this morning?
I got up at 4:45.
Yeah, and this guy's got some totally whack sleep habits. So don't think that he's got some master organization plan.
I just can't sleep.
This is just totally weird, but anyways, long day for you. All right, and we got a really interesting conversation to have here. Now, I was born in 1982, and from what I understand, and this is just kind of what I figured, that there was a recession in the country like right around then, 81 to 83, or what was the economy like right at that moment?
So we moved from here, Roseburg, Oregon, to Powell, Wyoming in 1981, and unemployment in Douglas County was 23%.
Yeah.
There was a serious slowdown here, and so it drove us to Wyoming.
And I think that recession was nationwide. That was not just here, but maybe it was worse here.
It was worse here because that was the environmental movement secured the Spotted Owl and the Endangered Species Act, spear-tipped by the Spotted Owl here as a way to really put the brakes on the timber industry here in Douglas County. And so the local economy just collapsed.
But wasn't there a national recession happening right then also?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. But nobody else had unemployment of 23%, I can tell you that, you know.
Yeah, for sure. We're going to kind of be talking through this because you were in Wyoming then for several years.
5 years.
5 years, framing, building houses, working for a contractor.
A custom home builder.
A custom home builder.
Yeah. Wade Welch, good guy.
You had experience when you showed up there, so you, that's not the place where you learned the basics or anything, but
sort of. My experience here when I showed up there was primarily contracting under my own flag, and I didn't know much. I certainly didn't know enough to do that. And then I built that sawmill and did all that too. But as far as carpentry, I was maybe the equivalent of a second year apprentice in a union apprenticeship program. I was about halfway to being a carpenter.
Got it. Wyoming, as most people will know, even if you just think about the stereotypes, is dark, very cold, very windy, very short days a lot of the year. What's the building season like there? And for a custom home builder like this fellow, what does that actually mean? Is that like building like one or two houses a year and then kind of hunkering down all winter? Or what does that actually look like?
I didn't miss much time because of winter. Okay. They've learned to work. But having said that, there were lots of mornings where you would get up and it was cold and it was dark. And we lived for a while in a little apartment across from a bank. And so the bank marquee would do the time and temperature. And I would get up in the morning early and it would be 30 below. And when I got home, just about the time it was getting dark again, it would be 10 below.
That's insane.
We went from 30 below to 10 below, from 30 below to 10 below. And that was the worst of it. But Powell, Wyoming is kind of a banana belt. The Bighorn Basin is a wonderful place. It's wonderful. Mm. And for a lot of the winter, I could work sort of like this, you know, gloves, a stocking cap, long johns, and pretty much like this. But for about a month or a month and a half, you had to dress for it, which is an interesting conversation too.
So what we really want to talk about here and what I want to ask is what it was like going from that place as a carpenter and showing up in, I think, the middle of the winter, if my three-year-old memory serves me correct.
I left you guys. I pulled out on a job-seeking mission, leaving you and Amanda and Adam with Kelly in that little house that we had just outside of Powell, New Year's Day. Mm-hmm. And I went down there with enough money to last for about 2 weeks and with the intention of finding a job because we had to go somewhere where there was work. Because 86, it was another economic tank, especially for Wyoming. Uranium, sugar beets, barley, beans, all and oil, natural gas, all went down at about the same time.
Yeah.
And so northwestern Wyoming was in a bad way.
Las Vegas had been, and pretty much still is, but experiencing a housing boom. I know in particular from the early 70s until, you know, I guess today. But that was certainly part of the heyday of that time. So maybe take a couple skips forward, not so much the job finding mission, but actually showing up and kind of getting your feet under you and working on those job sites. What did that feel like? How different was that? When you look back and think back at that, what kind of feelings and thoughts were you having?
So, we can tie.
All right. Leo wants me to tie his tie.
Yeah, we're getting close to Halloween, and Leo's going to be Harry Potter. And I mean, he looks like Harry Potter. He's got a Harry Potter tie. He's got the glasses. He's got the cape. If you haven't seen Harry Potter before, you're going to see him right now.
Yeah, if you're in your car, I'm tying a tie on a little blonde Harry Potter right now.
Yeah, that's right. It's awesome. So anyway, I don't know how much personal trivia is interesting and how much of it is not, but my pickup I had is a 1973 Ford 3/4 ton white flatbed. I mean, deja vu, right? I haven't changed much, but it didn't have a heater. And so here I am heading south out of Powell, Wyoming, down through Green River, and I get to Salt Lake, and I'm going down there New Year's Day, January 2nd, with no heater in that truck,
wow.
Which wasn't that big a deal because I was dressed like I was working, except the inside of the windshield would just ice up. So I'd have to scrape the inside of the windshield in order to keep driving.
Wow.
But by the time I got down getting south of Salt Lake, all of a sudden things warmed up, and I began to feel hopeful. Mm-hmm. But it was I kind of had to dig a little bit deep about security and insecurities and what I brought to the party and whether I was ready to kind of step up to what was understood to be sort of the construction big leagues, mm-hmm. you know, in Las Vegas. I had done a little research. 5,000 people a month were moving into Las Vegas. That was every month building a town the size of Powell, Wyoming, every
wow.
month. And I got down there. I left this high desert environment where occasionally you would see new lumber going up in the air. And the little developments, if you could call them developments, of custom homes, and there were no tract homes, would just have, you know, one or two a year going in. And I started driving down into the Las Vegas Valley, and you could see these sprawling tracts just covering the hillsides with new lumber just thick on the ground. Mm. And it was exhilarating. I felt hopeful for the first time in a long time because I thought, man, if I can run with these guys, there's all the work here I would possibly want to do. And so it was a combination of radical insecurity and radical hope.
Did you have insecurity, like you were uncertain if your skills and experience would translate to the way it was done there, or was
yes.
it something else?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, I just did not know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how I would stack up. I felt very provincial. I felt like kind of a redneck farm boy, someone from the backwoods. Had I learned anything that was actually useful in this environment?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I knew that I was kind of a runner. I knew that I knew how to work and that I had some sort of skill, but I had no idea.
It's really easy with the benefit of hindsight to look back and think, okay, but obviously Vegas was booming and growing and there was no reason to think it would be anything other than a screaming success. But at the time, I'm certain, especially since this was 86, 87, and there was a little slowdown then and certainly other economic issues. But what was it like on those job sites? Were people generally enthusiastic about the workplace, the market, the type of construction happening? Was it just business as usual when you showed up, or was there any sort of like energy, like, wow, look at, we're all making a lot of money here and this is great and we're going to be able to build, you know, as much as we could possibly stand, or was it just sort of a, you know, people getting their paycheck? And
so something that I didn't know anything about that I confronted right away, that there's a world of difference between small town, small builder, small community construction in Las Vegas, where it's sort of it's industrialized construction, and economy of scale forces specialization. And along with 5,000 people moving into a town per month, there was an economic of people, like an influx of people just like me that were economic refugees. Mm-hmm. We were, when we moved down there, you were a child in a family of economic refugees. And so there was a lot of people coming in like that, mm-hmm. which, so there's this huge amount of work being done and a lot of competition. Hungry dogs mm-hmm. coming in 5,000 per month looking for a foothold. And so yes, there was opportunity, but man, there was this sense of, well, getting back to the first part of this, I didn't know what I brought to the table. Mm-hmm. And it was a while before I began to recognize, huh, whatever it is that I bring apparently is in demand. And I began to kind of relax a little bit about that mm-hmm. and not be so uptight and uncertain. Oh, and then the other thing was the difference between small town construction mentality and an industrialized construction mentality is there's almost a prison mentality or a military, more a prison mentality on some job sites. Construction can be a very, or could then be a very oppressive place when you've got a tract of, and there's maybe there's 150 guys banging boards, you know, or you've got a high rise down on the strip, and maybe there's 600 men working in that, on that site, you know, and there is no forgiveness of sins. There's no accommodation for shortcoming. There's no, it's a thing where even in a crew, then at least crews that I found myself on, if you showed any weakness, man, you went to the bottom of the pecking order, and it's mm-hmm. no fun when you were in the bottom at the bottom of the pecking order down there. Then I've got to guess it wasn't like that in the small town where you knew who all the builders were, mm-hmm. and maybe you didn't get along with somebody on the crew, but yeah, you know, it didn't seem that serious. It didn't feel that serious.
So there was real hierarchies on the job site of
yes.
popularity and probably bullies and
yes.
and everything in between.
Yes.
And it was sort of a part of the day, I guess, was interacting with that.
Yep.
Almost separate from your work itself.
Big time. And as in Vegas then, construction was and probably still is a place where biker culture could thrive. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the bikers were a rough bunch. I mean, I was a kind of a naive country boy, and man, it was like, really? I mean, mm-hmm. these are, so one of the best men I ever worked with, when I left Martin Harris Construction, because, and maybe an interesting story. I was working union, and there were two different scales, union pay scales. And I found myself taking a pay cut to go from a big job to a little job. And so I went from A scale to B scale, but I had been requested by a superintendent, and I show up on this other job and my check is smaller and I didn't like it. And I got my nose out of joint, and I had heard that there was real money in the tracks, piece working. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'd rather frame anyhow than do footings and spread footings and, you know, set up foundations for red iron. And so I quit. But it was interesting because there was a type of individual all over down there in commercial construction that was rough. Mm-hmm. I mean, rough. And so I left commercial construction and I went into piecework in the tracks. And I started, the first thing when somebody shows up to piecework and they don't know anything about him, then, and I expect now, they'll give him a job sheeting a roof. You can't really screw up sheeting a roof too bad. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get the CCPTS with the one clear side on the overhangs and you can fall. At least then they didn't worry too much about if you were going to fall. If you could walk on the trusses and you weren't afraid to take the job and you would work for $6 or $7 per square foot, you could sheet that roof, son. So I went over there and went to work. And after about 3 days of that, there was a guy working across the street stacking and doing stairs named John Urban.
Okay, let me cut in for a sec. This is when you were doing piecework.
When I left the commercial construction environment in Las Vegas after a couple of years and stepped over into piecework.
Piecework, for the listeners, refers to doing a job and getting paid entirely on how much you get done. So if it was sheeting a roof, your paycheck was created on how many square feet of roof you sheeted that day, and every aspect of the job was sort of built in that manner, right?
That's it. Every little bitty specialty of the framing process had a different piece price agreement mm-hmm. and a different set of guys doing it. And they would go from house to house to house doing their little niche mm-hmm. and make some money at the end of the week.
So you met John Urban, was across the way.
John Urban, he was over there stacking by himself. And he walked across after about the third or fourth day and he said, hey, you want to partner up? I said, pardon me? He said, yeah, I do stairs, layout, and stack, and I need a partner. And I've been watching you sheet that those roofs, and I think we ought to partner up. He said, we'll split it 50-50. I realized now that was unheard of. He was an experienced hand, and he came over and offered a 50-50 split to someone that he didn't know. John was great. He was an example of somebody who came from a real tough background. Okay, John had experiences in his background that I today am still probably unable to pretty kind of wrap my head around. Okay, he had done, yeah, he. And so here I am partnered with this guy, and we're having lunch, and we're working on the job, and I realize, man, I'm not in Kansas anymore. This is a completely different work environment than anywhere I've been in the previous, what, 5 or 6 or 8 years that I'd been in construction. But there was so much knowledge available there, personal, interpersonal, trade knowledge. It was overwhelming, the amount of the stuff that was there to learn, and I loved that.
So the partnership he was proposing was you both basically work your brains out, and whether you're doing the layout or the stacking, you kind of team up, and mm-hmm. however much you both get done in the piece,
we scale, split it at the end of the week.
You split it at the end of the week.
You turn in the number of houses you got done to the to the superintendent at the end of the week. He'd verify, and he'd turn that in. And then whatever your agreement was, you would tell the superintendent, here's the amount of work we got done this week, and he gets 40%, and I get 60%, or I get 20%, and he gets 80%, or in John and my case, split it 50-50 mm-hmm. down the middle. And then the employer would payroll, you know, overhead and savings, and, you know, all of that would be subtracted from that gross amount, and you would get your check.
It would make sense for an experienced guy to maybe take a partner who is young and fast and offer him 20%.
Exactly.
And you're going to learn something.
That's right.
And you're going to basically, like, get my water bottle and grip my tools and stack whatever and just...
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right. I need some blocks and, you know, laying some plate up here. And they're called cubs. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cubs or cubbies. And I didn't like being referred to as a cub.
Oh, he called you a cub even though it was 50-50?
Even though it was 50-50. In his conversation with his other peers, who he had not partnered with, he said, I've got the ultimate cub here.
Yeah.
He didn't finish up telling him he was paying him 50%.
Yeah.
You know, but I learned a lot from John. I learned how to chain stitch my cords, and I learned production framing techniques from John, and I enjoyed working with him. An interesting thing, there's an Army Corps of Engineer statistic, you've heard me say this, that every time you double your crew size, you lose 20% in efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, so John and I were stacking, and part of being a piece worker is you may get 2 or 3 framing contractors you know. And if one framing contractor doesn't have a tract of houses for you to stack, you drive around, you find another tract, and say you walk in, and man, if there's walls up, if there's houses up plumb and lined, and there's trusses plate lined, or there's trusses sitting at the curb out in the street, man, there's work.
Yeah.
You go find the boss, you say, hey, I'm ready to stack. Okay, what do you pay? All right, here's a deal.
Yeah.
And off you go. If there's another stacking crew working there and they're behind, they're stacking and there's 2 or 3 or 4 houses ready, you can jump in ahead of them. And now you're taking work that they were looking forward to getting on in the rest of the week. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we were stacking some condominiums in Spanish Trails, really, really choppy. They were cut and stack. That is, they weren't trusses. All of the rafters and the hips and the valleys and the jacks had been cut by a roof cutter whose job was to cut the roof, and they were laying there in bundles labeled. The forklift would put them up and you would assemble it. And the track that we were in rolling trusses ran out. We drove into Spanish Trails, and here is here's these cut roofs ready to go, and there's a little crew of stackers there, about 3 guys. So we jump in, and pretty soon we kind of drive them out. We're faster. Boom, boom, boom. Well, the same thing happened to us. We were stacking along. We got behind 2 or 3 condominiums, and here another pickup drove in with a couple of young, looked like they knew what they were doing, and they jumped on one, and there was 2 houses ahead of it. And John said, okay, let's split up. You go grab one. Mm-hmm. I'll grab the other. Tie it up. They'll have nothing to go to. They'll drive off.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what happened. John and I had been stacking as a team, making $1,000 a week apiece for a year and a half. Now, that was pretty good in when would that have been, 92, 93. 1990. $1,000 a week was pretty decent. We split up and started stacking these roofs, these choppy cut and stack roofs, by ourselves. My take home went up 20%. Isn't that interesting?
Hmm.
It's harder. it's harder to work by yourself, more demanding, but you get more work done per man hour at the end of the day because of the moments when you're saying, John, hand me that board, and you're waiting while he's handing it to you. Or would you hold this up for me? And you're waiting while he's getting in position. That's unproductive time. And if you're working by yourself, you just find a way and more minutes are productive. And it's so funny how it corroborated that Army Corps of Engineers statistic. It was a 20% jump. We went from 1,000 a week to 1,200 a week working by ourselves.
So what happened after that? Was that pretty much the end of the partnership? Or,
kind of.
Or what?
We just kind of drifted. We realized, I guess we can stack. We can solo stack. And there's always a way to solo stack. You can roll trusses by yourself. You can set rafters by yourself. You can put in the sheetrock backing. You can do all of it by yourself with a nail gun. And you make more money.
So regarding just this general mindset at the time, was there, you know, today there's a lot of, there's a mindset of jobs are being taken by Mexicans and the construction industry is not what it was and this and that. And did that exist then? Not necessarily regarding Mexican, Hispanic workers, but regarding, I don't know, tools or technology? Was there old timers whining that like, oh, this is not the way it was? Or do you remember anything like that? Or what was the of feeling among the...
Well, to speak to the Latino influence and the Latino reality, one of the things I learned in Las Vegas when I was down there for... How long were we there? We were down there 8 years. You were 4 when we moved there and 12 when we moved out, I think.
Yeah.
I learned in that period of time that the average Latino construction worker was a better man than the average gringo construction worker. He had fewer bad habits. He was on time for work. He didn't cause trouble. He didn't get into fist fights. He didn't have to leave in the middle of the day for some unknown reason. He always had his lunch in the car. He had his own water. They were more productive. Now, I still have good friends down there. And the construction world that we moved away from in 1994 doesn't exist anymore. In the tracts, Warren Hafen tells me there are no white boys in the tracts now, that it's entirely Latinos. And it was about a 50-50 split then, but not anymore. And I, you know, I'm not sure what to think about that, except that those guys were then and undoubtedly are now hard, reliable workers.
Well, it's not a lot different than what happened on the stacking with you and John Urban, where a truck of productive guys show up and can get it done quicker, and the cost comes down for the builder, therefore the buyer of the home anyways. So the result is,
I guess,
a lower price of the home at the end of the day, and certainly a bunch of happy families. So
see, that's right. And because it was a perfectly level playing field in piecework framing, a level playing field. If you showed up with the tools and the know-how and you would take the job then for that price, bam. Go for it. And at the end of the week, you could make money if you ran. If you didn't run, well, you didn't make that much money. But, and so I can't look on the shift in the demographic now with anything except, well, that's just the way it worked because of the attitude of the labor force. That, you know, separate from greed or anything else, on the part of the framing contractors, they just want to get, all they want is to get those houses framed for a cost that they understand when they bid the job. That's all they need. That's all they need. And it has gradually morphed over time.
That's really neat. Okay. Well, certainly a different world, and there's probably ought to continue this conversation, but I think our video battery length is going to be our, be the end of this. Anything else jumping out at you on this topic that we should hit while we're here?
I just circle back and just point out how much I appreciated working with John Urban then, and what a pleasure it was, because there wasn't no better stacking team in the Las Vegas Valley when we were doing that.
Yeah.
One or two of the superintendents we worked for, one of them would introduce us as the premier stackers. Well, that was hyperbole, but man, we could really get it done. Two of us could kick out a lot, and there's such satisfaction. You're up there walking the plates. You're sliding those trusses around. You're burning through nails so fast that you just can't carry enough to keep it going. But there was real satisfaction in my 30s doing that. And I feel it has been a blessing in my life to have had that experience with John.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's easy to, at the time, yeah, like I mentioned, people can easily think this is not, things were better before, or this job site was, or this industry, if you would have been here yesterday, that kind of, that kind of a mindset. Oh, if you should have been here yesterday, it would have been even better. But it's important to remember, like you said, rolling into town and the feelings of uncertainty, the feelings of nervousness on job sites, the feelings of what's the economy doing? Will I have work? Those are all the same, regardless of, I would guess, when, which decade we're talking about. Yep. But those feelings that arise when you're uncertain and when you're learning and when you're in a new place, it, the tools might not be the same, the job might not be the same, but a lot of those feelings are exactly the same. And
that's right.
And probably even today.
So here's the real takeaway that I've learned that I almost forgot on the spec house on the when we were in crunch time, is that it doesn't pay to worry about what you're going to do in the future, because the skills and the abilities and the coordination, whatever it is that has enabled you to stand on your feet in the past, is going to enable you to stand on your feet regardless of what you confront. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some, I think there can be some comfort in that when a fear instinct would make things look impossible. And they're no more impossible than any number of other things that you've taken care of in the past with no trouble.
Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. This is, the video is posted on our second channel, EC2. If you want to tune in there, that would be the place to leave comments. And if you're listening in your car on headphones, thank you very much. And it's going to take us a while to really get the hang of this format. And it's just a different type of thing, but we're kind of excited. It hopefully will expand our ability to, you know, hit some interesting topics and you know, we're learning something new here as well. Anything to add?
Thanks for listening. And I hope it doesn't begin to sound trite, but it's important that you keep up the good work.